Welcome to Soil to Soil, a podcast connecting the dots in the life cycle of clothing and material culture, brought to you by Fibershed. Each episode offers a look at how and why our community is working to cultivate fiber systems that build soil and protect the health of our biosphere. Today's conversation is a crash course in the many people who make it possible for us to wear a wool sweater, knit with a new ball of yarn, or sleep on a wool pillow at night. I'm Jess Daniels, and I'm joined today by Stephanie Wilkes. Stephanie is a true Renaissance human, and she wears so many hats, it's hard to know where to start to describe her talents and all that she does. But I'll start here. Stephanie is a certified sheep shearer and wool classer. She's a writer, a teacher, a former tech industry project manager, and a contributor to many innovative efforts in our regional fiber system. We spoke just as Stephanie was launching her new book called Raw Material, Working Wool in the West. It's all about the people and processes that get us dressed but don't appear on the garment label. We talked about the influence of urban consumers on agricultural communities and the bright spots that keep her hopeful in continuing this work. Just a side note that we talk a lot about wool in this episode. Do note that so many of this applies to natural fiber systems broadly. And later in the podcast, we will be talking about hemp and linen and cotton, and this will just be an unfolding all about natural fiber systems across different plants and animals and breeds. Love you. Hi, Stephanie. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi, Jess. Thank you for having me. It's exciting.
Your work as a sheep shearer was featured in Vogue magazine, of all places, in October 2017. And you said that you learned to shear 5 years ago now because you couldn't find any locally made yarn. Tell us about that moment you learned that a lack of shearers was part of the disconnect between fiber producers and finished garments. Why did you decide to take matters into your own hands so directly?
So this is a difficult question to answer because my decision still does not make sense, like not even to me. But my initial interest was quite simply very selfish. As a knitter, I wanted local interesting yarns and I wanted wool growers to be able to make that yarn for me. I first read about the shortage of sheep shearers in The Knitter's Book of Wool by Clara Parks. And in it, she points out that the people who are most likely to produce interesting, unusual yarns are also likely to have smaller flocks and as a result have the hardest time finding a shearer. So shearers are paid on a per head basis. The more sheep we shear, the more money we make. So larger jobs tend to have more appeal. So if you're one of the few shearers out there and you can afford to be picky about the jobs you take, you're more likely to take a large job than a small one. Another reason that I took matters into my hands so directly is that I just had ignorance and what I call urban hubris in spades, which is the luxury of not knowing and of not even being able to conceive of how physically grueling shearing is. I'm a curious person and I like to try a lot of new things. So to my oblivious mind, shearing was just one more of those things. But it's funny because when people who have raised sheep read my book and they get to that moment when I decide to sign up for shearing school, their reaction is like the moment in a horror movie when we scream like, no, don't go into the haunted house. They have this real sense of dread and they're saying, no, no, don't become a sheep shearer because they know what's coming and they know it's going to be really, really painful. So that's the kind of hodgepodge, not very flattering answer of how I decided to become a sheep shearer. But my first motivations were honestly, if I'm being honest, just yarn selfishness powered by hubris. Really?
Well, I think it's unique. I mean, certainly not all knitters are going out and learning to shear to serve their own knitting interests. And I think that luxury of not knowing is something that your new book really touches on and kind of takes off the veil. Your book, Raw Material, Working Wool in the West, seems like this great blend of personal experience and observations, as well as the history of the American fiber industry and really tracing textiles from soil to skin. But in a way, it also seems like it's more about people than it is about process. When we think about the person behind the label of our favorite shirt, we probably first think of the person who sewed or constructed that garment, Who else have you met and who is involved in providing our clothing?
First, thanks for saying that, because I wanted the book to focus on people and on their lives and personal stories over process. So thank you. The answer is that so many people provide our clothing. So for an animal-based natural fiber like wool, there are the people who raise and steward the sheep in the land. So farmers, ranchers, and shepherds. Many of the shepherds are H-2A visa workers from countries like Peru and Uruguay, where there are cultures who have not abandoned their skilled shepherding traditions. There are farmhands, contract grazers who might not own the land, but might own the sheep and bring them through to graze. There are vineyard managers, there are the sheep ultrasound folks, and then all of the people who make the sheep vaccines and dewormers and salt and mineral blocks, and the people who work at the feed and farm supply, and then all the people who work for the local irrigation and weed management and resource conservation districts, as well as some of the land trusts in the county and state parks. They're all involved. And then more directly, there are all the sheep shearers and the labor in the wool sheds. So wool handlers who are picking up and running and skirting the fleeces. There are rousies, which is short for roustabout, who are sweeping the floor. They're to improve the fleece quality. They're moving sheep in and out of the shearing stations. There are wool classers who are grading the fleeces to improve the wool price for the grower. There are the people operating the baling machine and all the people who make and maintain all of the tools and clothing we use during those processes. Sheep crooks and bells and our shearing handpieces, motors, combs, cutters, shearing slippers. And that's all before the truck drivers go to the wool warehouse, the fiber testing labs, the wool auctions, everybody at the mills. They unload, they prepare, they label and scour and card and pin draft and spin and maybe even dye the fiber. And if there are dyes involved, you have dye plant growing, or in the case of petroleum-based or coal-based dyes, you have miners and the processing of things like coal sludge and the people who do that unpleasant labor and the dye houses. And that's all before anything is woven into fabric, much less sewn into a garment. And I know this might sound exhaustive, but I'm casting a deliberately broad net here because I want to show that there are a lot of people and labor and livelihoods involved all the way up and down the value chain outside of sewing. And every single one of those people is affected by policies and by personal decisions about the yarn and the garments we buy.
That's so true. And it is such a vast system with, as you just described, so many people involved in these very hands-on processes. And so I'm curious, I think there's this misperception. A lot of people are surprised to learn that natural fiber systems are still very human reliant, that even if we scale up a system to a supply chain that involves mills and mechanized processes, that it's not fully automated. What parts in your experience when we scale up, what parts do get automated and how much of this really relies on all of those people you just described?
Well, you're right. Most natural fiber systems are still almost, I think, completely reliant on people. There is very little that I see that is fully or even mostly mechanized. So shearing, of course, is fully hands-on, and likewise the skirting and classing of fleeces. So a trained, skilled person looks at and touches every single fleece that comes off of a sheep and in multiple areas of that fleece. So the human sense of touch is key to both shearing and wool classing. When I'm shearing, you know, our hands are feeling for the contours of the sheep's body, for any cysts or warm areas which might possibly be infected. We're moving the sheep's ears out of the way and covering their eye sockets with them, which is a way to protect the eye, but it also just keeps us aware of where everything is, including our own hands. Our legs are feeling the sheep and holding them, and with those, we can sense any stress or discomfort that the sheep might be having. And in terms of the raw fleeces, we're assessing fineness or coarseness, if you want to put it that way, length and strength and crimp and elasticity and any tender or weak points that might, you know, if the fiber breaks, make it too short than the 3-inch minimum required for most mill equipment. So even the most mechanized parts of the process, and the mills, I guess, are probably the most emblematic of that chain, require still a lot of human hands-on work as well. You know, there's somebody making up the scouring bath and keeping the water filtration and the temperature and humidity controls right, based on what particular fleeces might need. There's everyone keeping mill equipment repaired and running as it should, which is an incredibly difficult job, and managing the amount of wool that's going into the carder, everything. So that's why I think, to me, safety and air quality and the conditions in every single place matter, because there are people in all of those places, whether they're on the soil or in the mill or just living downriver of the effluent and the dyeways, there are people there.
Mm-hmm. So many people involved in every step of the process. And even having access to those systems can be really challenging.
Mm-hmm.
I've been reading your past blogs and articles. You do a lot of writing for your own site as well as other sources. And one really caught my eye. Back in September, you wrote a blog post on your site called Didn't Used to Happen. And it was about how earlier this year in 2018, when a farmer that you were shearing for asked, "What do we do with the wool?" you were able to recommend a local mill and even drop off the fleeces for them. And this post was about how changes in our regional fiber system are a critical proof that things can happen, that things can change. And so you wrote, "I think nothing of feeling bad. It's the feeling good that gives me pause." Why is that positive change more notable for you?
Yes, it's not just because I'm a bleak, dark cloud, I promise. Positive change is more notable to me because it is comparatively so rare. And because I think there finally is some. So, you know, if you're a person who's even a little bit aware of our typical levels of human consumption and the role that fast fashion plays in that, if you've even seen a few images, like a movie like River Blue or the Rana Plaza factory collapse in Bangladesh, just knowing or seeing that one thing can be so emotionally devastating and overwhelming that it can almost like paralyze us, at least me. We can feel very responsible and complicit, even though most of us were born into these very entrenched and powerful systems that began centuries ago, like basically with the Industrial Revolution. And I think one reason that this period of time feels so awful is because we are in a transition. So we know enough to know that what we're doing is not working in more ways than it probably is. And at the same time, a new or hopefully better system is not yet defined or in place completely, and it's not going to be for a long time. So we're in a paradigm shift, I think, and that those periods of time are very hard. And so every so often, in the middle of what I call the mess, and sometimes it's quite a literal mess because I'm covered in manure, but I also mean like the climate mess, and the wage mess and the justice mess, I get to enjoy these very rare, very palpable moments that something has gotten better and there is something better in place and that it might even be part of my new normal. Like that moment where I said to the farmer, "Oh, I'll just take the fleeces up to a local mill," was as if I had been saying it for ages and I hadn't, but it had become normal. It was becoming normal to me. So I have to remember to rejoice in those moments and savor them, because I think they are the bright lights that keep us pushing when the slog feels especially long and impossible and thankless, and the task in front of us seems so monumental that it is actually quite doable. Like, we can do something and it can add up.
Wow. Yeah, that's so powerful. I think the monumental changes that need to be made are also underscored by the volume of natural fiber and the system scale perspective that we have. Mm. And here in California, we actually produce roughly 3 million pounds of wool per year. And so there's a lot that needs to change because we're not even fully utilizing all of that material that we have growing locally. And I'm curious, do you still see shearers as one of the primary barriers to rethinking that system into this paradigm shift, or has your perspective changed?
I think shearing is still a barrier. I still hear about certain communities in particular that have a tough time finding shearers because of their geography. We're working to help them, but I do think it's getting better. I think shearing is sort of having a moment right now in terms of popularity due to things like the Vogue article you mentioned, but also the recent release of the She Shears film in New Zealand. So every year from where I sit, there are more shearers I can call to take jobs. So I feel like the pipeline is filling and it needs to keep filling, because of course people stop shearing to do other things, or they retire or get injured or they start families and take a couple of years off and that sort of thing. So I think it is getting better, but I have also noticed the other systemic issues that are keeping us from wearing what is grown here. One of them is reputation or branding. So American wool including a lot of our California wool, is very fine and a very high quality, you know, objectively in terms of like wool testing and things like that. But it's not perceived as being on par with Australian and New Zealand wool. And I think part of that's marketing, but part of it is also that American wool itself suffers from historic baggage. So many people, especially folks I've heard from earlier generations, associate wool with itchiness from their coarser, like 1950s fabrics and yarns. And they're not even aware of wool that is spun so fine that it can feel like a cotton t-shirt, or that can be machine washed and dried due to the superwash process. So branding in a large sense. And another systemic issue that we have, and this is in terms of both growing and processing fiber, is fairly low volume. So the US does not have the sheep numbers and thus the wool production of Australia and New Zealand. And here there are not many ranches, especially in California, that on their own can produce like 10,000 pounds or more of wool that are required to achieve a minimum order quantity at a large processing mill. And that minimum order quantity is basically the volume that is required to make it worthwhile for a mill to turn on its equipment and pay its workers. So there's a volume issue there, which, you know, something like pooling wool together of a similar quality might be able to address. And another one is just the systemic burden and the risk that is disproportionate on the wool grower if they want to process their wool into a finished product. So the first one is money. So a wool producer who has sheep must also have upfront capital to ship the wool to a mill, and then also the many hundreds or several thousands of dollars to have it processed. So they've paid for a year's worth of animal care and feeding, vaccinations and vet bills, and they've paid the shearer. And now on top of that, they have to pay for scouring and carding and spinning and transportation. And after all that's done, they're still carrying inventory unsold at the risk that they might not be able to sell it later. So the wool grower is out a lot of money and effort for what may not be very much payoff or any reward. And it's very risky business for them. So having that all on them is just another systemic issue.
Yeah, so it's risky on the grower side, but I think this is something we also hear from designers, from the manufacturer side as well, that it's, you know, it's risky for them to kind of reach out, extend their hand farther into the supply chain. Do you see any positive notes on a paradigm shift in that regard of bringing those ends of the spectrum together?
I think that even if we bring the designer and the wool grower together, that they can still end up bearing a lot of risk. And that's the toughest thing to figure out. And certainly we have seen some, I think, worthy experiments in trying to have consumers simultaneously offload both of those entities, where, you know, the wool grower, like pre-orders for fabric. So before the wool is even shipped to any mill, people have ordered their fabric, or people have ordered a finished garment, and everybody's kind of paid up front to reduce that risk. And I think we need a lot more experimentation there. Those are very promising, but they require a ton of marketing effort to make people aware of those opportunities. So I think that, you know, looking at maybe almost like community R&D funds. I don't have a ton of really fleshed out ideas on this subject, but I have seen some very promising things happen when the wool grower, the mill, the designer, and the customers are working together on the kind of same timeline toward the same outcome.
Yeah. And it seems like there's an alignment of goal as well, or desire. And I know that you also did research for Fibershed on value-added products, and that consumer education was seen as a leverage point there as well, that again, along those, like what the growers want, what the brands want, what consumers are wanting is transparency to the farm level. Mm-hmm. Can you say more about what you found through that research?
The study that you're referencing had qualitative and quantitative aspects, and the qualitative ones were talking to and interviewing people about what they wanted. And then the quantitative work was business model analysis. And so that was looking at some existing wool businesses and looking at things like price points and margins and really nitty gritty spreadsheet stuff. And the interesting thing there was that like the numbers really do work a lot. Like, there are people getting paid decent wages. There are good materials being used. There's additional money going toward, say, a carbon farm fund, and the business is still making money. So, you know, there's a lot of promise, I think, in the sheer numbers. And then understanding that we have in place a lot of what people want to hear about, and that we just need to talk it up. And one of the blog posts I've been meaning to write is about traceability and literally how it works. Because, you know, traceability, saying, oh, we go back to the farm and here's a nice video about the farm we get it from, that plays well. But there's also some really interesting systems in place that help, that literally enable the traceability. So in the book, I talk about how wool is traced. You know, every sheep has an ear tag number to track them for disease and also ownership. And it, you know, you can shear a fleece and I grab the sheep and I call out the ear tag number, and somebody writes that ear tag number on a note card, and that note card goes in the bag. So we know that that fleece came from that sheep. We even can, you know, when we put fleeces in a bale, we know which, you know, which grade, how many fleeces of which grade were in which bale and what part of the flock they came from. And that bale has a number, and the wool grower has a number, and the wool classer has a number, and all of those numbers travel down the chain. So I think we have the other optimistic thing that I saw in the research is that, oh, wow, we are actually already, because of our existing systems, really well positioned to tell these stories about traceability, and it won't even be that hard. And that's kind of what the industry calls, you know, low hanging fruit, like something that you can, that you don't have to work very hard to get, and you can start to promote, and it might help connect customers and farmers a little better.
And I think that's exactly what we need.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
To put it bluntly. So that's interesting, because there's an ear tag on every sheep, which enables this potential for transparency and this low-hanging fruit. And yet at the industry scale, there's this kind of monolithic branding or perception of Merino, almost to the point that people think all wool is Merino, or, you know, that it's all sheep are the same. And I know in your teaching, you also teach workshops, you give people a taste of their local wool and learning about local fiber, and you actually call them wool tastings, which I think is brilliant. What do you mean by sheep and wool terroir?
So first of all, you're right that Merino has become synonymous with wool, and it is no accident. That is a very fascinating story. I hope to hear it on Invisibilia or something someday, but it was a very deliberate, extensive branding exercise on the part of Icebreaker, and it completely worked. And we can learn a lot from that, but I won't go off the rails about that. But that's no accident. So by sheep and wool terroir, and I probably don't ever say it properly, I mean, for me, the special and unusual and really almost the magical qualities of these beautiful fibers that we don't even know are right around us. If they're not in our backyards, then they are not terribly far from them. And I liken that fiber wool terroir experience to the one that people have when they taste a bright orange farm egg omelet for the first time, or they have a ripe heirloom apple or tomato or strawberry after they've been eating watery, underripe, comparably flavorless stuff. Because that initial experience of touching something that isn't Merino, and especially when you have a bunch of different yarns or raw wool samples together and you can compare across them, it's a revelatory experience, and it's almost otherworldly, even though, of course, it is very much of this world. And that was how I felt when I began to knit with these more unusual local fibers. And it's a feeling that I want to share with other people. And so I don't mean to toot my own horn here or go too woo-woo, but it is not at all uncommon for people to cry in my workshops when they start handling raw fibers. And I didn't know what to do with that at first until I just realized that it was this very powerful, tangible, immediate sensory way that yarn can be so much better and fibers can be so much more different than the typical stuff might lead us to believe. And it is really beautiful. It's like hearing beautiful music or seeing a beautiful painting. So Merino does get all the credit, even though it's actually a family of breeds. It's not just one. But for hand knitting and finished garments, for example, it can be too soft. It can lack structure, and it can pill and break as you knit with it. And Merino doesn't always wear well or last. And then So, you know, you have that experience and you get your hands on like a raw fleece or some yarn for some Santa Cruz Island sheep, and it's smooth and stretchy and springy and it's lovely to work with. Or you see the depth and breadth of the color that's in Jacob yarn, which can have this lilac cast. It's really a purpley brownish gray. And it's phenomenal, and it's not even dyed. So there is something magical about it. And for me, that's what wool terroir is. It's what we have around us, and that's no different from our wine, which I will point out is from the vineyards that sheep graze oftentimes, or the cheese from the same sheep. And so our clothes are part of that, and we don't think about them that way, even when they literally grow on the same animal and on the same landscape as the things that we eat. So I directly apply that label, but I'm sure I'm doing it in an Americanized way that would horrify French people.
Well, I think that provides a beautiful metaphor, and you're right that it does really connect us to what's in our backyard. And I know for you, you actually live in San Francisco, so you have an urban backyard. And I'm curious if your neighbors were surprised or are surprised when they learn that you shear sheep for a living. Because as urban residents, we tend to imagine agriculture as something that happens out there, you know, far beyond us and kind of outside our immediate community. But you're going through your shearing all over the place in a greater sense of your geographic community. And I'm wondering if sheep shearing has changed your perspective on the so-called urban-rural divide.
It definitely has, yes, in a lot of ways. I started shearing, and I still live in the city, because it was something that I could do. So when we talk about wanting to be more connected to the land, our mainstream story of that is that somebody buys land or buys a farm and hijinks ensue, and they have all kinds of wacky adventures, and then they stay on the farm. And here in California, in terms of land prices and land access, that's not always possible. So I was like, well, why not? You know, where I'm living doesn't constrain the farms that I can drive to and serve. And there are actually quite a few sheep close to me, and even some in the city. But my neighbors have called me crazy to my face, and not in a good or endearing way. They'll often say a common comment is that I can make a lot more money grooming dogs, which I'm sure is technically true, even if it's false equivalence in terms of skill, fiber market. And in terms of the urban-rural divide, yes, I have a very different perspective now than I did 5 and 6 years ago. I definitely knew that I knew nothing about farming, and I have always known that. But as people say, the more you know, the more you know you don't know. And so the depths of my ignorance just become clearer with each passing shearing job, really, even today, I think. The main reason that I wrote Raw Material was to show that rural folks are doing some of the most of the hardest and most thankless work that there is. I knew that, but then there's really knowing it, right? There's really seeing it every day. So they're grazing for fire control, and they're saving suburban and urban homes in doing so. And they're also reducing the use of fuel and synthetic fertilizers, and they're getting no credit for that. They're helping vineyards and orchards and rice and wheat and meat growers maintain the organic and biodynamic certifications that we so love to see on our products. And they're kind of hidden behind that label. And then meanwhile, in San Francisco, I'm seeing people, and I'm generalizing here, you know, but buying whatever they want with some consumption that's pretty out of control, and booking flights and flying all over the place without a second thought as to the carbon emissions, and then kind of patting themselves on the back for buying an electric car or voting to ban plastic bags. And so the disparities become, I think, more pronounced and a little harder to handle. And again, at risk of generalizing and really off-putting everybody, but I feel like those urban folks are kind of more dangerous in a way, because they believe they do know about farming. And that's the difference, is that somebody will see a 2-minute video about a chicken farm or almond farmers on Facebook, and they'll, you know, think that that's the extent of the information, and they'll start commenting on California state policy about how irrigation water should be allocated or how long sheep should be able to be transported in a trailer, when they know nothing about sheep, their bodies, the ruminant system, the interior of a trailer, how long people stop, you know, to give their sheep a break when they're on a long trip. And so I will often say when I hear these things that I'll feel like things are fair when ranchers get to regulate computer code and the production of it. And I'm not really joking, because I kind of see urban people now as having a totally outsized influence on regulating farmers who don't get to really regulate people in the city. And I definitely think I'm coming to share some of the frustrations that some of my customers have expressed. Also, what's been really interesting is that I'm back on the receiving end of what I will call class bias. So I am no stranger to that, coming from a blue collar family. But now added to that blue collar bias from white collar people, I would say there's the urban bias on agricultural workers. So there's a real difference in what happens if somebody introduces me as an author or a writer or a consultant, then I'll be treated more as I used to be. But if somebody introduces me as a sheep shearer first, in a lot of contexts, if people are not fascinated, which does happen, I will often just be outright ignored or passed over, like just interrupted straight up. People will start talking over me and I'm kind of invisible in the truest sense. And I'm sure it's nothing that any rural resident does not already know or experience, but it was funny to go from being a tech worker to being like this kind of looked down upon agricultural worker a lot of the time. It's okay though. It's worth it.
When you went into shearing, when you came from that tech worker background and really got into it as a knitter and as an urban resident, did you have that sense internally? Did you think you were going out and kind of knew what farming should look like or what you wanted to see on the landscape? Mm-hmm. Has that shifted for you personally?
I didn't. Because I didn't even know enough to have specific ideas, honestly. I'm from such an urban place, you know. I grew up in and outside of Detroit, and it's so urban and suburban that I think it's like looking at a painting in a museum. You know, there's a painting hanging on the wall and you might have a feeling about it, but unless somebody who was an art historian tells you about the elements of it and who made it in the context of where they live, you kind of don't know what you're seeing. And that was definitely true for me in landscape. So I think I didn't have a lot of expectations. I didn't even know enough to form expectations. That's probably why.
That strikes me as a kind of open-mindedness, or maybe a reserved judgment that we could all benefit from. Especially if we're talking about, you know, pretty large scale paradigm and system shifts. And I think it's really exciting to follow your work as you're involved in some very exciting systems changes in our regional fiber economy. You've been involved in these two unique structures. I'm sure there's more work going on behind the scenes, but I wanted to highlight these two. One was your work with the Mendocino Wool and Fiber Mill when you helped support a direct public offering to garner investments for the mill to get started. And the other is that you've been involved with launching the Northern California Fiber Shed Cooperative as an agricultural cooperative supporting a community of fiber producers and artisans through direct economic activities. And I think there's this idea when people hear about local wool and regional supply chains, there's an assumption or maybe even kind of a fear that we're going backwards or we're fixated on the way things used to be. But these two structures are bringing a new form of development, and it seems like a novel way to make regional fashion our future. Can you share some of the ways that these examples are breaking the mold?
Yes, I can. And I think it is new that they're being applied to fashion. So, right, there's nothing new about agricultural cooperatives, really, but applying it to fashion is new. And I'm glad that you brought up this idea that some of us are somehow nostalgic for a domestic manufacturing era of the 1950s or something, or that we want to get back to the way things used to be whenever that might be. There were definitely some beneficial things about that period, like historically high wages, which is what I think people miss the most. But there were a lot of harmful things too. And growing up in a factory town with family members who almost exclusively worked in factories, I feel I can confidently say that the only things people really appreciate about manufacturing jobs were the wages and the accessibility in the sense that somebody with like a less than high school education could do the work and make a decent living. But otherwise, you know, factories are really loud, they smell bad, they're hard on your body, they are not always safe, and you're doing often the same thing over and over in this Taylorist assembly line model of work, and it is not always enjoyable, and it's feast or famine and layoffs, and you know, if you've ever set foot inside a non-air-conditioned textile mill in the deep south in the summer, like nostalgia would just not be the first feeling that you have. So I think these newer structures or even new versions of established structures are breaking the mold. In terms of scale, you know, they are smaller. Our local mills are not the size of a South Carolina mid-century textile mill, and they're not aiming to be. But also in terms, not just in terms of like building scale or operation scale, there's also this acknowledgement pretty openly that we just cannot have infinite growth with finite resources, and that is not even necessary or desirable. So it's new and it's interesting to see businesses applying and kind of really embracing this idea of small is beautiful, this economy built around the needs of a community instead of an entire country or instead of corporations. So for example, I think both Mendocino Woolen Fiber and Valley Oak Wool Mill, which are the two newer mills in our region, those owners know a great deal about the wool that is produced here, the qualities of it, the varieties of it, and what their equipment needs to do to process that wool. Not to say they would not take wool from another state, but they are very mindful and kind of community driven in the fiber that they're processing and learning to process. They're also optimally located to be a short, fairly affordable drive for shearers and the wool growers themselves. They're an accessible distance. They are near freeways. So they're very community driven, even though from the outside, they might just look like a mill. And, you know, to your point about participation, it's not just that these businesses are built around the needs of a community, but it's also community ownership. Because we just don't need to go back to the same tired, exploitative models of the past, and I would say also of the present, of course, which is a few people getting rich while a majority of workers and their families and the businesses that those workers would support are kind of held at the whim of a corporate board and some distant shareholders. Instead, we are seeing community shareholders and cooperative members that inform and ensure control. And that can be, you know, community control can be kind of a vague term. And the story I use to explain why ownership matters is that 1 year ago tomorrow, we learned that Cone Mills, which is more popularly known as Cone Denim, was closing its last U.S. mill, which was the White Oak plant in Greensboro, North Carolina. And White Oak closed because a private equity group, Platinum Equity, bought it. And they did what private equity does. And I know this because I worked in private equity for a very brief time before I saw what was going on. They close it in the name of efficiency. It's not profitable enough. And I think we're just at the point now where we can say, you know, human beings in a community have different values than a private equity group, as we might expect. And that's fine. But it does not mean that different businesses can't be successful. I think that it's a mistaken assumption that like different core values means no profitability, like that there's only one path to profitability. I don't think that's right. So, you know, it's very early days. It is not clear yet if our local mills will survive or how profitable our very brand new months old agriculture cooperative will be, but why not try? Right? Because what we did in the past did not work. We are in a terrible situation of extreme pollution and carbon emissions and fast fashion because shareholders expected infinite growth in a finite universe, which is a ludicrous premise. So we have to at least try other things, I feel like. So why not?
And I think that's a really hopeful message to share, because I think there's often this sense, or at least I certainly feel like an internal tension on what is the role of being a consumer and of consumerism, and can I really make a difference on an individual level? But that vision you just shared with us around community control and community ownership really puts people at the forefront and gives us some agency to impact these systems and to help co-create the systems that we want to see.
It's a really great point. It's very important. Thank you for that.
Sure. Well, on other important points, if you could dispel one myth about American wool, what would it be?
That it's itchy. It's not itchy. In addition to superwash, which I know, you know, folks have different feelings about superwash processes, but it does make it possible to have a very soft feeling fine wool that you can machine wash and dry. There are just a lot of American sheep breeds that grow wool that on a micron basis in the lab measures as fine as some merino. So there's Targi and Corriedale and Rambouillet and other fleeces that are fine and soft, but also have qualities that make it better than merino, like more crimp and more strength. So it's not itchy. Not all of it.
Right. And I'm excited to read in Raw Material more about that. So my final question for you is, who grew your clothes?
I'm so fortunate to be able to say Robin Lind of Meridian Jacobs in Vacaville. I have a couple of shawls from her that I wear almost daily. Sally Fox has grown cotton that I have sewn into a caftan style dress and some pants. Lani Estill and her wool fabric, and I have things knit from yarn from Mary Pettisarli and Jackie Post. I have Pendleton shirts that started as wool at the Barnhart Ranch in Ellensburg, Washington. And I have sweaters that I've knit from fibers from farmers at various fiber festivals in both Oregon and California. And I know that in my jeans, there's definitely some cotton from West Texas and Georgia in there as well.
And Stephanie, where can we learn more about your work and keep up with all of these different projects that you're involved with?
Oh my gosh, how can I keep up with the new agriculture cooperative you mentioned is at norcalfibershedcoop.com. The Fibershed Marketplace, which is the first service or product that the agriculture cooperative owns and runs, is at fibershedmarketplace.com, all one word. And my personal website is stephaniewilkes.com, and my name is spelled strangely. It's stephaniewilkes.com, and I'm Lady Sheepshearer on Instagram.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Stephanie.
Oh, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Love is back in a trailer. Turn one way and it goes the other.
You just listened to the first episode of Soil to Soil, a podcast by Fibershed, which is a nonprofit organization based in Northern California. We invite you to learn more about our work and the concepts we talked about here by visiting www.fibershed.com. There you can find our show notes for this episode, which will link directly to some of the resources and research that Stephanie and I talked about. You can also sign up for our Fibershed newsletter, where we share updates on our research and goings on in the community. You can also connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter if you search for Fibershed. To learn more about Stephanie's work, head to her website, which is stephaniewilkes.com, spelled stephaniewilkes.com, or follow her on Instagram at Lady Sheep Shearer. To support this podcast and Fibershed's work, we would love it if you would subscribe and leave a review on iTunes, because we're just getting started on this platform and we really hope it will help us reach more people to hear these stories and understand the systems that we're talking about from soil to soil. We also welcome your feedback by email. You can reach us at podcast@fibershed.com. This podcast is produced by Fibershed in collaboration with Whetstone Magazine. The music has been provided by Aaron Harris, who's a member of our Northern California Fibershed community and based in Petaluma, California. You can find links to these great folks and more at fibershed.com.